Welcome to the presentation of the 2011 William E. Simon Prize for Philanthropic Leadership. I'm Peter Simon, co-chairman of the William E. Simon Foundation. I speak for everyone at the Simon Foundation in saying that we are happy to be partnering with the Philanthropy Roundtable in the administration of this prize. My father was one of the founders of the Institute that eventually evolved into the Philanthropy Roundtable, and I know how delighted he would be to see how this gathering and the Roundtable has grown. Congratulations, Adam, and to all your people. Dad will also be delighted with the choice of Charles Koch. Charles has effectively promoted his convictions that free market principles, individual liberty, and personal responsibility are the foundation of our nation's prosperity and the best means to foster social well-being. It is so wonderful that so many people have joined us this afternoon to pay tribute to this remarkable man and who has shown so much leadership through philanthropy. We will soon have the opportunity to hear more about Charles' extraordinary work, and I encourage you to read Jim Glassman's cover story about him in the copies of Philanthropy Roundtable at Philanthropy Magazine at your seats. But for now, I'd like to take a moment to say a few words about the man who created the prize for philanthropic leadership, my dad, Bill Simon. Dad, who many of you remember from his time as Secretary of the Treasury during the Nixon and Ford administrations, was truly a pioneer. He was our nation's first energy czar. He took the reins as president of the United States Olympic Committee during the most tumultuous time following the 1980 boycott. And he subsequently established the U.S. Olympic Foundation with the profits of the 1984 Games. It was the first U.S. Games to ever turn a profit. He wrote two best-selling books that advanced free market ideas that at the time were thought to be radical. He was also a pathbreaker in the business world in the use of leveraged buyouts as a cutting-edge investment strategy. Yet even with all these accomplishments, the things that remained most important to him were his family and the responsibility of being a good steward of the wealth with which he was blessed. Both he would say, if done correctly, were among the hardest and most important things that a person could do. The purpose of this ceremony is to salute ideals that Dad carried close to his heart. Effective philanthropy, individual freedom, scholarship, and helping people to help themselves. Dad strongly hoped that the prize for philanthropic leadership would become a beacon of inspiration, motivating others to take great care in their charitable giving and to support programs that are truly making a difference. A donation of $250,000 is made to a charity of the prize recipient's choice, and I'm confident that Charles has once again chosen wisely. In receiving the Simon Prize, Charles Koch joins the ranks of an extraordinary group of past recipients, the late John Walton, Ray Chambers, the late Sir John Templeton, David the Admiral Robinson, Dr. Ben Carson, Rich and Helen DeVos, Frank Hanna, Truett Caffey, and Nancy and Phil Anschutz, who you will hear from in just a moment. And last year's recipient, Roger Hertog. The William E. Simon Foundation Board of Directors would like to thank the Selection Committee for this 2011 prize, most of whom are here this afternoon: Kim Dennis, Robbie George, Russ Hall, Adam Meyerson, Tom Tierney, Don Weinberg, and my brother Bill, who couldn't join me. He's at Parents' Weekend for his freshman at Williams. So now to introduce Charles, it is my privilege to welcome one of our most accomplished leaders, Phil Anschutz. You all know inspiration, pass it on. Phil and his wife, Nancy, have done nothing short of that nationwide. Their Pass It On campaign, which places positive and empowering messages on billboards, buses, and other public venues, encourages people to reflect, be inspired, and be grateful for the blessings of their lives. Their family-friendly entertainment brings to life incredible stories that appeal to young and old alike and bear witness to the enduring impact of strong character. And finally, their dedication to local charities in their home state of Colorado illustrates their gratitude for those working to keep the state safe and healthy. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Phil Anschutz.
Thank you, Peter. I knew your father. I know your brother, Bill, and many members of your family, and you and your family are doing a great job in carrying on the fine heritage of your father. You know, the philanthropy roundtable folks asked me to speak for 5 minutes about Charles. But regrettably, what they didn't know is my wife regularly tells me that I can't speak intelligently for 5 minutes about anything. Plus, I can't hold a thought for more than a minute or two nowadays. I always regard a man's wife and children to be part of a successful team. Liz, Charles's wife, he and Liz have been married for 38 years, and they have two very fine children, Elizabeth and Chase, who they're very proud of. They're fine children and have an outstanding career of their own. So they are part of Charles's successful team for how to be successful in life. So congratulations, Charles. You married well. Let me set the stage for my brief introduction of Charles, and it's this. Kansas. I know that's the state everyone in the room flies over, but Charles was born in Kansas. Now, what that means is Charles grew up every day having to walk 5 miles to school and home. It was uphill both ways all the time. And there was always a stiff wind in his face. But it was darn good early training for what was to follow. And what followed was Charles's very successful business career. In fact, a phenomenally successful business career. That success was accomplished on a solid foundation of ideals, hard work, with a long-term commitment to creating value. His success has in large part been due to his intense intellectual curiosity and a passion to understand how the world works and the benefits of a free society to advance human well-being, prosperity, and peace through economic freedom. Now, golf is another important passion, I think, to Charles. I know this because I watch him on the practice range and facilities just outside my window of my little cottage that I have, and I watch Charles working so intently all the time to improve his golf game. By the way, at age 75, how many of us are working to improve our golf game? Except Charles. But of course, I suspect it's not about golf. It's more about commitment and discipline. What really needs to be said about Charles Koch is not about his business successes. It's not about the fact that he's led a normal, moral, and quietly committed personal life. It's not the fact he's been incredibly generous philanthropically to people who really need his help. It's not even the fact that he's determined to shoot his own age on the golf course. All of these things are, of course, wonderful attributes. The real quality we should applaud him today for boils down to this basic question. What do you want to do with your life now? Do you want to do nothing, or do you want to do something? Something of great and lasting importance. Now, all of us in this room are committed to the latter course of action, or I'd suggest we wouldn't be sitting here today in the first place. But Charles epitomizes, better than most, that quality and commitment of getting off the sidelines, getting onto the field, and becoming a real player. Knowing, of course, in advance that he's going to be attacked and he's going to get beaten up in the process. As Teddy Roosevelt wrote in his well-known piece on this very subject, the credit belongs to the man in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, and who spends himself on a worthy cause. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you a great warrior and a great American fighting on behalf of all of us and helping to determine the ultimate direction that this country decides to go. Charles Schoen.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Phil, for that extremely generous introduction. Now, Phil, for you to have come up with something that favorable and positive, you must have been reading articles on me by such media as New York Times or Washington Post, or you wouldn't have gotten those ideas. On a more serious note, I am truly honored to receive this award named after Bill Simon, who I knew and admired for many years. Matter of fact, I think I met him, Peter, when he was the energy czar. That meeting wasn't as happy as... although I think he agreed with me on the points, but he didn't have any choice. But Bill, in my experience with him, was a man of great insights. And the other part of that is those who knew him could agree with me, he was not the least bit bashful about sharing those insights. It's a little bit of an understatement. But I want to mention just two examples. One, and some of you may know this story, I'm sure you do. After Ronald Reagan was elected president, he said, Mr. President, he said, now, if you want your vision to become a reality, you can't populate this administration, your administration, with retreads from previous Republican administrations. What you've got to do is go out in the private sector and find people who believe the government is doing too much and want to cut it back and get back to the private sector as quickly as possible. Now, sadly, Bill's great advice was not taken. Now, the other example of Bill's great advice was advice for me, which I get a lot, as from Liz and others, but... and her advice is usually right and very insightful. But in this case, I was meeting with Bill and I described the donations we were making to various universities for programs on economic freedom. And he says, Charles, you're on a fool's errand. He says, any money you give to these universities is worse than wasted. It will be turned around and used to undermine what you're trying to achieve. Now, so this is what was great. One of the things that was great about Bill is you were never in doubt where he stood on an issue. And the other part is he was usually right. Now, the other reason I'm particularly honored by this is as was mentioned, is the quality of past recipients of this award, and I couldn't be in better company. And I include you in that, Phil and Frank and any other recipients who are here. Now, my own philanthropic efforts were shaped in the early 60s, and this may surprise you. It wasn't because of Woodstock or any of those things, but by my passion to understand the principles underlying peace and prosperity. And because of that passion, I read everything I could on the subject from every discipline and perspective. And along the way, I encountered the writings of people like von Mises, Hayek, Friedman, and so on. And they convinced me that societal well-being was only possible in a system of economic freedom. And as you know, I've been a strong proponent of that view ever since. Now, let me just quickly define what I mean by economic freedom. I mean a system in which private property rights are fully respected under an impartial and beneficial rule of law, where people are free to trade with whomever they choose for what they need and want. They have sound money, which gives people an effective medium of exchange, and the second part is important, and reduces boom-bust cycles. Finally, that the government is kept small and limited to those activities that actually contribute to societal well-being rather than undermining. Okay, that's a brief overview. I won't belabor that more. We can do that another time, if you got several hours. Now, I also applied these same principles, as Phil mentioned, to business in developing our management philosophy, which we call market-based management. And at the heart of market-based management is the view that the role of business in society is to contribute to societal well-being. And if a business isn't doing that, it shouldn't be bailed out, it shouldn't be subsidized, it should go out of business, it should go broke. Now, business does so by practicing what we call principled entrepreneurship, which is maximizing long-term profitability by producing products and services that make people's lives better while using less resources and always acting lawfully and with integrity. Now, I'm not claiming perfection in that regard, far from it. But this is and has been our goal to which we dedicate major resources. For example, we have 1,500 full-time compliance and EH&S professionals who are constantly training and mentoring our people to improve our performance. Now, I believe that philanthropists should also be practicing a version of principled entrepreneurship. And this is not as easy as it sounds because of the difficulty of doing so without prices and profit and loss to give feedback on whether what you're doing really creates value. But I think other parts of market-based management can help overcome that obstacle. And one such tool is what we call the problem-solving process, which has five dimensions: vision, virtue and talents, knowledge processes, decision rights, and incentives. And I'm going to take my remaining time and briefly describe, if anyone falls asleep, it's okay. Please don't snore, though. I don't go for that. I'll start with our vision. Our vision is developed by determining those activities for which our core capabilities can create the most value, taking in consideration second and third order effects. And that's something we neglect to do, all of us, many times when we're in political or nonprofit activities. So the first rule in this is to do no harm, which is what Bill Simon was warning me about in dealing with universities. And as we all know, there are many, many horrific examples of philanthropy doing more harm than good, such as advocating poor countries stopping the use of DDT, which led to so many deaths, all with the best of intentions. Similarly, aid to developing countries in many cases, rather than helping the poor, has hurt them by strengthening and enriching the ruling elites. Now, I'll go over to the positive side. On the positive side, we strive to support social services in a way that actually helps people help themselves, rather than undermining their culture, causing them to lead a life of dependency, which is, I think, the worst curse for them. We also ensure that our philanthropy recognizes that theory and history have overwhelmingly demonstrated that the best way to help the poor, and for that matter, the rest of society, is through a system of economic freedom. In fact, philanthropy on social issues that doesn't advance economic freedom is generally just treating symptoms rather than the underlying problem, and tends to provide only temporary help, and in fact, in many cases, does more harm than good. Then we encourage our recipients to understand who their customers are. And customers for a nonprofit are those that the nonprofit was designed to help or influence. And that is not donors. What we find, so many nonprofits treat their donors as customers. And this becomes circular and self-defeating because they aren't advancing their mission. They're just staying in existence. So donors should be treated as investors, where their return is the nonprofit actually accomplishing something, not as customers. Now, then, as with vision, we apply the remaining four dimensions of the problem-solving process in selecting and helping us select who our recipients are, as well as in our own organizations. So the first step in this, after developing the vision, is building the culture and talent necessary to make the vision a reality. And in our view, this starts first with hiring people, first on virtue, and only then on talent and ideology. The way I look at it, if you're going to hire somebody that's evil, you better hope he's slow and stupid. Because if he's smart, he's going to do a lot of damage. And we've experienced that. And this is especially true for the CEO, who at a minimum needs to have integrity, humility, and treat others with dignity and respect. And if the CEO doesn't do that, I recommend quickly getting a new CEO. And in particular, we avoid CEOs with the great man syndrome, who believes he needs to call all the shots. Then we measure outputs tied to the vision rather than inputs or activities. For example, rather than simply measuring the number of people who participate in a program, we attempt to measure to what degree the program has changed them in a way that ties to the vision. So we strive to avoid the tendency to just measure what's easy to measure. And as I say, in philanthropy, this is much more difficult than in business, to measure what's easy to measure as opposed to what will move the vision forward. Also, we treat other nonprofits with a similar vision as allies to cooperate with rather than as competitors, which we see so many nonprofits do. I think it comes down to, are you there to advance your nonprofit or advance the mission of your nonprofit? Are you there for your own ego gratification or to really accomplish something? Then we strive to get employees, board members, and donors to really understand how they can best contribute and to have the right people in the right roles depending on their values and capabilities. Finally, we reward employees according to their actual contributions to advancing the vision. And we work hard to eliminate perverse incentives, and this is critically important. especially those that lead to compliance problems or the worst curse of all, an entitlement culture. So this has been a brief overview of our market-based approach to philanthropy. And although we found it to be very powerful when it's applied correctly, which isn't that easy, it's much easier for me to talk about it than implement it, its use appears to be very rare. So I hope some of this will prove useful to us, to you, as it has for us over many years. So again, I thank you for this award, and I'm honored to be in such distinguished company. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Charles. Philanthropy is central to what makes America unique, and it is leaders like Charles Koch who challenge all of us to celebrate, take advantage of the liberties that we are afforded here. Charles, we're so honored that you have accepted our prize. Thank you so much for inspiring us by your example and helping us to do what we do, to be the best philanthropists that we can be, and to take seriously the power and responsibility of the wealth we have been entrusted with. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us in honoring Charles Koch.